Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock from Hobart, Tasmania. You are listening to forest ecologist David Bowman. Well, David, we've talked about getting that carbon released from the trees as they burn, but there's another aspect to this. There's new research out of the Journal of Geophysical Research about the role played by black carbon. They found black carbon, including from forest fires, is the second leading cause of global heating behind only carbon dioxide. What can you tell us about the black carbon impacts of wildfire smoke?
Yeah, really interesting effect that the wood smoke is a really interesting chemical cocktail and physical cocktail. It's not just like combusting the carbon, it also is putting black carbon. Black carbon is an incredibly efficient way of heating the atmosphere because it's black and it's soot. It's aerosols in the atmosphere, so it can heat up the atmosphere. Now, the critical reason why black carbon is so important is that it messes around with cloud formation. And there's great concern that you can actually aridify regions by injecting these plumes of black carbon into the atmosphere. And, of course, another feedback, that if you start drying out a region, then you start increasing the likelihood of fire. And before you know it, you're getting a nice, steady source of this black carbon, which is actually changing the regional climate, and which would then change the fire activity, which would then change the vegetation, which would then change the world.
And if some of those forests convert into grasslands finally, they just burn too many times, then again we've lost something that was formerly sucking up the atmosphere and creating rain clouds.
Correct. The concern, the vulnerability of the Amazon or tropical rainforests, which are now increasingly recognized as extremely efficient at recycling moisture. So not only are they carbon stores, but they're also water pumps. And the vulnerability of drought and fire to these systems, and you can imagine what many ecologists are beginning to see as these not gradual declines, but actually switches, abrupt catastrophic switches of state. From, say, and you know, there are good examples in the northern part of the US and in Canada, we've got pine forests which are getting burnt so intensively that they don't regenerate after the fire, and you switch from a forest to a prairie. So you can actually have these catastrophic switches. And as soon as you do that, it's very difficult to ever come back to the forest. You can get back to the forest, but it's difficult. It's got a bigger hole to climb out of.
And we've got problems here in North America right along the Rockies with beetles that are boring into the trees and killing them. So now we've got whole vast valleys of dead trees, and the American West is drying right out. All of that is affecting these trees. Are there similar things going on in the Southern Hemisphere or less so?
Very, very good question. Less so. The most drought-affected part of the Australian forests are in southwest Western Australia, where the trees are literally collapsing from drought stress. Now, in those situations, there's great concern that you're elevating the fuel load, and because you've got all of this extra fuel, you can imagine you could be going towards some sort of vegetation shift. But around Tasmania at the moment, the droughts haven't been severe enough. But if what's happening in southwestern Western Australia is sort of like the leading edge, if you get strong enough drought, we can imagine that we could be looking at some state shifts. There is another example of a state shift which is a little bit related, but related to the effect of fire, and that's where you get double or triple fires in very short succession before the trees can mature. And we're worrying that there are areas in the Australian Alps which may have been converted from forest to some sort of degraded forest. I'm not saying all of the trees have been eliminated, but certainly a vast quantity of the trees have been eliminated from these double fires because the trees were killed, they set seeds which regenerated, which were then killed very quickly in other fires which happened maybe 4 or 5 years later, which is at an extraordinarily high frequency. You know, we would normally in nature, you would expect the next fire to be 40 or 50 years later.
So if we get more fires faster, that matters.
Hugely, hugely. It's like, a classic sort of demographic catastrophe where you're just never letting anything mature. So you will get things that can mature, but they got to mature quickly. So you may be driving it into some sort of uber fireweeds, you know, these sort of super plants, which just get to mature fast, you know, ready to burn again.
We're talking with forest ecologist David Bowman from Tasmania. David, there have been some international efforts towards agreements to protect rainforests, for example, from intentional burning, and there's been talk about changing the burning of agricultural waste. Are these talks pointless? Are we getting anywhere? What would you suggest?
Well, I think that the horrifying interactions which I've been talking about and their capacity to accelerate change probably has been overlooked. So we are making progress, yes, but the threats and the compounding effect of the threats has probably been underestimated by policymakers. It's not to criticise the climate modellers, but, you know, we have a very sort of thermostat view of climate change, and, you know, we're 2 degrees, 1 degree, 4 degrees, you know, but no, we're talking with fire, we're talking about the tails of the distribution, the extremes. And the terrifying thing is that those extreme events start messing with the thermostat. In other words, the worst case scenario is we could lose control of many of the things we thought we had control of. We don't have as many options as we think we have. That's the worst case scenario.
Frankly, from the scientists I've talked to, I think we're at that point, or we're very quickly approaching it. What are you looking into these days? What research needs to be done?
Well, I'm doing two things. Being in Australia, we have an extraordinary opportunity to understand fire. It's probably one of the most amazing fire laboratories on Earth. We are doing, in collaboration with an American colleague funded by NASA, we're looking at the effect of these big fires all over the continent and looking at fuel, the fuel types and the amount of fuel that's burnt in these big fires. And that's a comparative study because that will be comparing the same methodology to the Western US and into Brazil. So there are global comparisons which are critical. Another project which I'm collaborating with another US team and New Zealand and to a degree South American is that we're looking at reconstructing fire activity in the Southern Hemisphere and understanding whether there's some sort of modality that when New Zealand burns or when Tasmania burns is at the time when Chile doesn't burn. You know, what are the big-scale climate drivers that maybe have put some sort of tempo into Southern Hemisphere fire activity. The Southern Hemisphere isn't well known, and these flammable landscapes have sort of been overlooked, but they're extremely interesting, particularly Australia because of eucalyptus. So, of course, I'm studying eucalyptus, trying to understand its ecology, and I'm trying to understand whether eucalyptus has done something evolutionarily different and become maybe the plant equivalent of us, because we're the fire animal and maybe eucalyptus is the fire tree. And if it is the fire tree, future generations may be wondering why the hell did these guys spread it all over the world, because it's going to take with it fire. And we are hearing reports of concern about eucalyptus, say, in the Mediterranean. It's in a league of its own in terms of plants that like to catch on fire and spread sparks and hoard flammable fuels and all the rest of it. So, yeah, they're the sorts of things. I've obviously been working with Aboriginal people and trying to understand Aboriginal fire use. That's something which has preoccupied an enormous amount of my life because I got annoyed at people theorising about prehistory and we still had Indigenous people burning country. So I went into Arnhem Land in Northern Australia and over 15 years have worked with one family group and watched and worked with them, studied with them, how they burnt land and how they felt about fire. And it's a very different way to think about fire than we have. They're very comfortable with fire. Fire's like their pet. It's their friend. It's just their thing. Kids play with fire.
This is fascinating stuff. From Hobart, Tasmania, we've been chatting with Dr. David Bowman. He's a professor of forest ecology at the School of Plant Science at the University of Tasmania. I'll put a link to his profile in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, and you can follow up from there. David, it's been so good talking to you across this great Pacific Ocean that we share.
No worries. It's been good talking to you, and enjoy your winter.
Okay. Bye-bye. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please don't forget to support Radio EcoShock. Help pay those bills. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or at our show blog at ecoshock.info.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith with a case you probably haven't heard about. The U.S. federal government seems permanently on the edge of bankruptcy, as you know, and the public always wants lower gas prices at the pump. So now the Obama administration is auctioning off huge tracts of the Outer Continental Shelf to big oil and gas companies. Our guest, economist John Talberth, says that's a bad idea on so many levels. His group, the Center for Sustainable Economy, has taken the government to court to stop it. John Talberth, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be on the show.
Well, surely the U.S. should be aiming for energy independence. Why is your group trying to block these new ocean oil rights with a lawsuit?
Well, first of all, the path to energy independence is not to take us down the path of more dependence on fossil fuels. I mean, A, it's not sustainable. B, it comes at enormous cost. And C, the resources that we're actually developing on the Outer Continental Shelf and elsewhere are not really being designed for consumption in the U.S. There's, in fact, a large portion of these programs that are being developed for the export market. So there's no real correlation between energy independence and the new fossil fuel programs that the Obama administration is pursuing, including developing the Outer Continental Shelf, which, of course, is the subject of our litigation.
Well, what is the official name for this program?
Well, every 5 years, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management develops what is known as the Outer Continental Shelf Oil and Gas Leasing Program. That's the official name of the program. It was authorized by Secretary Salazar in late August, and we filed our lawsuit, at least the initial pleadings in our lawsuit, in early December.
Well, before we talk, John, more about that lawsuit, I think we need to deconstruct a little of what you said in the beginning, because there are fundamental issues at stake here. First of all, just as a business decision, why would they organize to sell off natural gas rights when gas prices are so low that existing leases haven't even been developed yet?
It's not just gas, it's oil. We're at a time when there's a record backlog of leases, not only of natural gas in the West and the Northeast, but of unused oil leases offshore. It makes one wonder, given just how sensitive these resources are, and given that we really need to be stretching out our oil and gas supplies as long as we possibly can, why the administration is rushing headlong into a new program to develop these leases offshore. So the only economics that makes sense is when you consider what these new oil and gas leases do for oil and gas companies' bottom line, their balance sheet. And what these companies get to do is put these new leases on their asset sheets as assets that they eventually have the rights to develop, and thereby keep their share prices high and keep interest in their companies high enough to keep going economically. So it's really just about helping oil and gas companies meet shareholder expectations and not so much about meeting America's energy needs.
Well, that sounds like a kind of subsidy, and I like the idea that your lawsuit raises the point that our children and grandchildren might have a right to national resources as well. That seems so obvious. Did the government consider that?
Not at all. One of the key contentions in our lawsuit is that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, the Obama administration, did not consider at all, in any way, shape, or form, the vast economic benefits that could be realized if we defer new leasing decisions until we really demonstrate that there's a need for this oil and gas. And so, you know, under the National Environmental Policy Act, this is kind of known as the no-action alternative, and it's supposed to be treated in a fair and balanced way in comparison with the action alternatives in the cost-benefit analysis. And instead of treating the no-action alternative in a fair and balanced and unbiased way, the administration simply chose not to look at the economic benefits of waiting or not developing the resource at all.
Well, that's a major point. And then we have the huge costs of damages if another big oil platform burns or leaks offshore, like the Deepwater Horizon did. Did they look at that?
They purport to have, but as you know, the technology associated with deep water drilling, and just in the latest round of leases offered for sale, there's at least 32 individual lease sales that have been executed that are in waters even deeper than Deepwater Horizon. And we're at a point where the technology associated with keeping those wells safe is not nearly as far along as the industry makes it out to be, and as the administration thinks it is in the context of its programmatic documents it used, it relied on to authorize its new program. So the technology really isn't there. It's questionable. We're seeing evidence of that all the time. We just saw another drilling rig disaster in Alaska. We saw another drilling rig disaster just a few months after Deepwater Horizon and another one last summer. So clearly, we're putting our shores at risk for energy supplies we don't really need. And this is kind of the crux of the lawsuit, that when you look at the economics of the risk versus the benefit, it just doesn't add up.
Right. I did a little investigation into this. I had a look at the maps for the leasing areas, and some of them are in the fragile Arctic where there are no spare rigs to move over and cap a blown-out well or anything like that. And the maps show lease sales areas like huge in the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea, right on the very northernmost coast of Alaska. Is that what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. And then offshore in the Gulf of Mexico as well. And the irony is that we're, you know, should those leases be developed, there's a very high likelihood, at least in today's market, that the refined oil products and even the gas, increasingly, that will come from these wells will then just be shipped overseas. So Americans get all the risk and all the cost, but we wouldn't even get the benefit of consuming these energy supplies under this existing program. That's another consideration that the Obama administration completely overlooked in its economic analysis.
And there were some interesting little details on the maps. All the proposed lease areas in the Arctic appear to be within a line identifying, quote, polar bear critical habitat seaward extent, and also within an area marked subsistence high use, which I presume must mean space used by the Inuit people for their subsistence hunting. So the government knows both wildlife and Aboriginal people in the north are going to be impacted. Did the Environmental Protection Agency leap in there and do an analysis of that risk?
Just in a very cursory manner, but our lawsuit focuses on the benefit-cost analysis. And what we have demonstrated over and over again in other situations in the Arctic and elsewhere in the U.S. is that when these big infrastructure projects or big energy projects are put in sensitive subsistence areas, the government has an obligation to do it the best job it can to quantify the economic costs and benefits associated with developing the new project and developing new oil and gas leases on subsistence uses. They didn't do that. They didn't assign any kind of values to those subsistence uses or factor in the cost to subsistence users. And that's, again, another way in which the benefit-cost analysis is biased in this case in favor of new drilling as opposed to deferring or excluding areas that are highly sensitive.
Funny how it always works that way. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. John Talberth, an economist who heads up the Center for Sustainable Economy, and that's based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're talking about new oil and gas leases being given out to major fossil fuel companies in sensitive and dangerous parts of the outer continental shelf. Well, John, when we think of climate damage, too, just consider the $60 billion relief package proposed for Hurricane Sandy. There's a lot more of those coming in the future if we keep pumping out this oil and gas. Did the EPA calculate the real cost of grabbing more carbon from the deep ocean shelves?
You know, that cost is, as we all know, is astonishing. And it just should be the governing factor in whether or not new fossil infrastructure is developed. What is this going to do to the Earth's climate? We already just saw today the announcement that 2012, at least in the U.S., was the hottest year on record. Every time we look at the temperature trends, it seems like we're on the worst-case scenario. And with that as the backdrop, it's utterly irresponsible for the Obama administration to be pushing new fossil fuel infrastructure development to the extent it is. And part of the reason they're doing that over and over again is based on faulty economic analysis that don't put a price tag on the cost that each metric ton of new carbon that is burned and goes into the atmosphere is creating on the economy downstream. So, you know, it's just another example of how biased and distorted the economic analyses on which they're relying to authorize these new projects.
Well, you know, we can't put a cost-benefit analysis on the fact that this kind of action drives some of my listeners nuts to see how insane it is to drill more oil and gas in the Arctic, just as we're getting all the news about the sea ice melting back and Greenland glaciers really are melting back. Doesn't anyone in the government see how crazy this is?
There are plenty of people in the government who see how crazy it is and talk to us behind closed doors, but when they actually make decisions, lo and behold, those people are kept in the shadows. And this is one of the tragic realities of energy policy in this country, is that notwithstanding all the positive talk President Obama engages in terms of, you know, we need an energy future based on renewables, and all the governors coming out together saying we've got to make the transition, and the public being loud and clear about it. When it comes to actual decision making, where we're actually putting federal dollars, state dollars, local dollars, you can follow the trail of that money right back to the new gas wells and the new oil rigs and the new coal mines. It's just, you know, one of the tragic aspects of energy policy in this country is that all the talk about renewables and making the transition and conservation and efficiency is all talk and bluster, while the actual decisions on the ground are to keep on developing new fossil resources.
Well, I think we're just addicted. So, John Talberth, please give us the details of the lawsuit against this resource sell-off. Who's backing the suit? Where is it filed? And all that stuff.
Sure. Well, the Center for Sustainable Economy is the sole plaintiff. However, we are backed in the lawsuit in terms of providing legal support by the Institute for Policy Integrity at New York University School of Law. Center for Sustainable Economy has filed this suit on behalf of our partners and members who reside in the Gulf region, reside in the Alaska region, who are deeply concerned about America's energy policy and the risk of another blowout like Deepwater Horizon, and really want to see us taking the transition to renewables seriously. Now, there's three key issues in the lawsuit and three statutes under which we're litigating. Those statutes are the National Environmental Policy Act, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and the Administrative Procedures Act. In terms of the issues, there's three. First, we believe the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management relied on a deeply flawed economic analysis, as I just discussed, to approve the program. The analysis fails to either meet professional standards or those set by law. As one example, despite the legal requirements to only consider benefits to the American public of new energy resources that are developed, BOM actually considered oil and gas industry profits, including foreign firms and benefits to foreign consumers from export of the refined product. So that's kind of the first bullet, is the flawed economic analysis. The second issue is that the programmatic environmental impact statement that they developed under NEPA supporting the program is extremely biased in favor of new drilling relative to the no-action alternative that would leave oil and gas reserves in the ground for future generations' benefit. And the third issue is that the BOM failed to incorporate the option value of waiting to develop additional oil and gas reserves in the future rather than now, and to demonstrate that we actually need these oil and gas reserves in today's market. So these are the issues and the statutes we're litigating under.
And what court is it being filed in?
It was filed in the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals, which is established by law as where one has to file in challenging the Outer Continental Shelf oil and gas program.
The House Budget Committee requested a report from the Congressional Budget Office on how much money could be expected from these leases. And in the Arctic, it's only a few billion dollars, and some of that goes to the state of Alaska, all that risk for so little. But who is the chair of the House Budget Committee? It's former vice presidential candidate, Tea Party backer, and deep friend to the oil companies, Paul Ryan. It's the same Ryan who wants to keep $40 billion in oil company subsidies. Paul Ryan got over $100,000 in campaign contributions from Koch Industries. He speaks to and for the Koch brothers at various events. He questions or denies the science behind global warming. You know, so congressional leader Paul Ryan pushes this sweetheart deal for the oil companies to get their hands on resources owned by the public. Do you think I'm wrong in assessing it that way?
Well, you know, there's only a few explanations, and that's certainly one of them. And again, getting back to the argument of why are we moving ahead with new leases, why the oil and gas companies are just sitting on a huge backlog of them, it gets down, again, to their balance sheets and the fact that they get to count these as assets, private assets that help prop up their shareholder value. So the entire benefit really is for the oil and gas companies. It has nothing to do with energy security and America's energy independence. You know, it's as good a guess as any.
Well, I understand that one auction for the offshore leases already went ahead in November 2012. Can your lawsuit stop the continuing sales of these public resources?
Well, if the court agrees with us, yes, it certainly will. We're seeking to remand the program back to BOEM to do an adequate job in its economic analysis and seriously evaluate whether new leasing is actually required at this time. If the court agrees with us, it would bring a halt to development of these new leases.
Well, now, I understand that Bolivia and Ecuador suggested they would leave some oil and gas in the ground rather than damage the climate further. They worried about future generations. But we're still not hearing anything like this from the U.S. government, are we, or are we?
We're not hearing anything at all. As usual, in the realm of energy and climate, the U.S. is playing catch-up. You know, now that the election is over with, perhaps the Obama administration can step up to the plate and demonstrate some leadership rather than lagging behind as we've historically done.
Well, John Talberth, you're an economist, the doctorate and all for the Center for Sustainable Economy. The bottom line, is fossil fuel, is that economy sustainable?
Absolutely not. By definition, it's not sustainable because there's only a limited amount of reserves, and there's even more limited amount of reserves that are economically feasible to develop. We may have already hit that mark. In fact, the scientists tell us, just from a purely from a climate change economic standpoint, that we need to be looking at leaving at this point 60% to 80% of the proven reserves in the ground as the only way that we're actually going to be able to meet the objective of holding the global temperature rise down to 2 degrees centigrade by 2050. So we may have already reached the point where developing new fossil fuel resources is impractical for economic reasons and for climate reasons. And it is our intent in this lawsuit to get the government to seriously consider the benefits of deferring or not developing the resource at all. If it does need to be developed, then perhaps it needs to be developed at a time where we really need it, when we're not exporting oil and gas at record levels.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add? And also, is there a website where people can keep track of what's happening with this case and these leases?
Yeah, absolutely. The Center for Sustainable Economy website at www.sustainable-economy.org. All the updates and the postings and the lawsuits and the filings and the lawsuits are available there, and we will keep you up to date. And just in closing, you know, I just have to say that in the run-up to the election, it was apparent that both the president and Mitt Romney were trying to outdo each other with who could build the biggest pipeline and drill the most holes. And it was really a low point in the history of this nation's debate over energy policy. And we're hoping, at least, that this lawsuit can now change the terms of the debate to get back to public interest economics. What is really grounded in good economics that is of benefit to the American people and is not just a chit to be used in the election cycle.
This is Radio EcoShock, and we've been digging into more skullduggery as public wealth slides cheap into private hands, endangering the future of all. Our guest is Dr. John Talberth, President and Senior Economist for the Center for Sustainable Economy. John, thank you so much for taking this stand.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be on the show.
I'm Alex Smith. Find links for this interview, including maps of the ocean rights being sold off, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock as we report from around the world. Thank you for listening.
Radio EcoShock.
We'll go out with a bit of a new song from Kukulkan, Mother Nature, Mother Earth.
Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, mankind ain't been so kind to you. Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, I can hear you crying. Deforestation, industrialization has taken a toll on you. Ice caps are melting, changing ocean currents, and the weather in the sky. Oh, Mother Nature, oh, Mother Earth, I can hear you.